So today, we're going to talk about our gospel lesson that we just heard, Jesus telling this parable. And first, I'm going to start with a little background of the laying the scene and kind of what's going on. It was the same as the scene next week or last week, and it's going to be the same for the coming week. So I thought we should talk about that so we have some sense of what's going on here in the gospel right now. So this is Jesus in the temple in Jerusalem. This is during the last week of his life. He's already, you know, walked into town with the coats and everybody shouting Hosanna that we celebrate on Palm Sunday and the palm branches. He's already thrown out the money changers, flipped over their tables, you know, made a cord and whipped them and thrown them out. He's already done that. He's already cursed the fig tree. And then he starts showing up in the temple to teach. Now, last week's story was Jesus teaching in the temple, and the chief priests and the elders, who are the people who run the temple, showed up and said, "Hey, who are you? And by what authority are you doing these things?" And Jesus said, "Well, I'll ask you a question. By what authority did John the Baptist teach?" And they didn't know what to say, because the people believed in John the Baptist, but the chief priests and the elders did not, and so they didn't want to get the crowd to turn against them, because they knew people like John the Baptist. They're like, "We don't know." And Jesus said, "Well, I don't know." And then he told this parable about two sons. And the father says to the sons, "Go and do this thing for me." And the one says, "I'll go do it." But then he goes and doesn't do it. He just goes and does something else. And the other one's like, "I will not, I'm not doing that." But then he turns back and he goes and does the right thing that his father wanted. So that was the parable from last week. And of course, the point is that you're supposed to do the will of the Father, not just say you're going to do it. That's kind of the idea with that one. And so in this week's story, this continues. And so we have now a series of weeks in which Jesus tells these parables, these contentious, sort of tense parables with lots of different groups of religious leaders. So the chief priests and the elders, this week they talk about the chief priests and the Pharisees, and then it's the Pharisees and the Herodians, and at some point it's the Sadducees, although we skipped that one, I think, and the scribes, all these different groups of religious leaders in the temple. And Jesus goes and sort of talks to each one of them, and they challenge him, and he challenges them back, and it's this real contentious time, all of which is happening because Jesus knows that his time is short, that this is the last week of his life. Jesus knows that this is his last chance to convince people that God has a new plan for them, that God is doing a new thing, that they can choose to see what God is doing. So it's a challenging time. So let's see, this week's parable is another famous one about this landowner and the tenants who try to take everything for themselves. So, you know, the landowner's there, he leaves these tenants in charge, and then when he sends his servants to harvest the produce, the tenants kill them, and they beat, and they stone, and they kill them. And then he sends another set, even more, servants to get the produce, and they kill them too. And then the landowner sends his own son and thinks, "Well, I'll respect my son," but instead they kill the son because they want to keep the inheritance, they want to keep everything for themselves. In hindsight to now, we can see that this parable of Jesus is talking about the landowner as being like God, and all the servants that he sends that are killed are the prophets trying to set the people in the right way. And the son, of course, is Jesus, his own self, talking about his own death, his own imminent death. That's how we understand this parable now. Of course, Jesus' audience then, these chief priests and religious leaders and the crowd who was watching, had no idea what he was talking about. That's clear. Now, I want to take just a moment to be sympathetic to these wicked tenants, as they're called, partly because in this story, we are more likely to be like them than we are like any of the other characters. So think about these people. They got hired to work this land. The guy who owns it's just off some, who knows where, some other country, for heaven's sake. He's not around. And so they spend the whole time working this land, doing these things, growing these things, the fruits of their labors. And now somebody wants to show up and take some of it from them. I mean, they made a deal, so they should keep the deal. But ultimately, they're the ones that have the land. They're using the land. They're working the land. They're doing the things. Why should they have to share with somebody else? It can be hard to let go of the fruits of our labors, of the things that we do. It can be hard to share the power that we have. I mean, they sat there every day and had these visions of how great this land was and how great this yield was going to be and how much money they could make on it and how this could change their lives and be really good for them. And now somebody's going to come along and take some of it. Well, they don't like that. They don't want somebody to take it. I think that's a very natural and human impulse. They did the work, so why should they have to share? The trouble, obviously, is they took that way too far. They took this sort of normal and even reasonable human impulse, and they allowed it to grow and fester and curdle into greed and murder, right? They killed people. They got so attached to their vision of what was theirs and what they thought they had earned that they were willing to kill other people just to get it. You know, they didn't want to... It's like they wanted to become the landowner themselves, right? They didn't want to just sort of get what was theirs. They wanted to take the place of the powerful person. They wanted to be the one in charge. They wanted to be the ones that had everything, had all the power. They weren't going to share with anybody else. And that is obviously evil. It's bad. It's a way that people go in real life. I mean, I can imagine a situation where these tenants started out with decent intentions and reasonable arguments, but all they did was talk to themselves all summer. They didn't talk to the landowner. They didn't get another perspective. And they just sort of built up this idea in their head, and they got more and more attached to it and more greedy. And their, you know, like the dollar signs in their eyes got bigger and bigger until they wouldn't even have recognized themselves at the end. They're just, I mean, thieving murderers. That's what they've become. So Jesus tells this powerful and violent parable, and then he asks the religious leaders, the chief priests and the elders and the Pharisees, whoever was there, what should justice look like for these tenants? And their reply is particularly violent and vindictive. They said to him, "He will put those wretches to a miserable death and lease the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the produce at the harvest time." Just a quick caveat, as I read it today, it said there was a little bracketed thing at the beginning of the reading that said, "Jesus said to the people," and he told this story. I think that's wrong. I think that Jesus was speaking most directly to the chief priests and the religious leaders, and that's who responded, and that's who this conversation was. And yes, the crowd was certainly there, but the crowd was watching. They weren't involved in the conversation. When they said to him, "He will put them to a miserable death," the conventional, as I understand it in my research this week, the wisdom is that that was the chief priests and the religious leaders speaking, not the whole crowd of people. So I just want to point that out. So this violent and vindictive response from them, this is what should happen. Those people should be punished most severely, right? It also became an indictment of their own actions, because, of course, Jesus was telling this parable about them, about these religious leaders, who had gotten so used to the power that God had given them and through the generations that they had acquired in being the people who oversaw the temple and the religious and political power that was enmeshed together, and that they were part of the people that was negotiating with the Roman Empire to make sure that everything was safe, that they were the people negotiating with Herod, that they had this tremendous power, and they had gotten too used to having that power. And so when somebody like Jesus comes along and challenges them and asks for a new way of doing things, their response was to want to have him arrested. That's what happened in the story today. They wanted Jesus to be arrested. And they realized that Jesus was telling this story against them, to shame them, to humiliate them in front of the crowd, to undermine their authority. Just as they had come in the story we heard last week, immediately before this, and they had come and tried to undermine Jesus' authority. Jesus does not hold back. In this last part of Jesus' life, he's really not pulling his punches anymore. Jesus said to them, I'll quote, "Have you never read in the scriptures, 'The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is amazing in our eyes. Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people that produces the fruits of the kingdom." Just because your name is on the sign on the door at the temple there, chief priests and elders, doesn't mean that you are the people who will gain the reward that God has for the faithful. Now, I need to insert this very important caveat at this moment, because this story and even the Isaiah reading that kind of goes with it really well have been used throughout Christian history to the end of anti-Semitism, to say that Jewish people and the people of Israel are bad and that God is going to replace them with somebody else. That is not the intention here, and that's not a way that we can go with this story. And particularly, as I've said, many of you heard me many times say, you know, in the Lutheran tradition, have a long history of anti-Semitism. It's awful, from the writings of Martin Luther through obviously the entire Nazi Germany thing, where the vast majority of the Lutheran church said, okay, Nazis is cool. All of that is terrible. We can't do that. That's not what's going on here. Jesus came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it, we read elsewhere. And we know that the promises that God made to God's people throughout the whole of the Old Testament, none of those promises were ever broken or changed. So God continues to be with God's people, the people of Israel, even as this new thing is happening in Jesus. You know, I'm pretty sure a thing that we don't talk about enough, and I need to think about this more, but like, Jesus wasn't a Christian, right? I mean, he wasn't like worshiping himself or whatever. Like, that's not quite what it was. Jesus was a faithful Jewish person who was leading the religious movement in a new direction. Jesus wasn't a Christian. It's not like Christians are good and everybody else is bad. Stop all that. Just get over it. So, anyway, so let's not let this be anti-Semitism. That's the point of all that. Instead, we can use this story to be a warning to us, because we are an established religious people who have grown comfortable in our worldview and in our role in the religious world. And to me, most of all, a religious leader who makes my living off of being a religious leader, right? I'm definitely a lot more like the chief priests and the elders in this story than I am like anybody else. And I got to keep that in mind. I'm used to getting my way in religious circles. I'm used to being the one that people defer to and being right. I'm used to having my authority not be challenged. And so that's it's a good, powerful parable for preachers and pastors to hear and to consider where we truly stand in these things and consider when we're putting our own interests above those of God and God's people. So anyway, these religious leaders realized that Jesus had set them up and then knocked them down, and they were furious. They were furious that this vagabond preacher would come into their house and humiliate them in that way, in that public way. And God had put them in charge of the temple. This was God's will that they were in this role. And they conflated, these religious leaders, they conflated Jesus' disrespect of them with disrespect of the temple itself and with disrespect of God. They thought because Jesus was disrespecting them, Jesus was disrespecting God, and they were mad about it. They wanted him arrested. But they were afraid to do that because they didn't want the crowds to turn against them. Because ultimately, the people, they knew that the people had more power than they did. Even as the leaders. The crowds were on Jesus' side. I just want to make a quick note here about political violence, because that's basically what this part of the story leads to. When the leaders of the temple were wanting to arrest Jesus and throw him away, but they were afraid of the crowds, they were wanting to use their power to do violence in the name of their politics and their power, and they were afraid of the crowd rejecting that and starting some violence of their own. Politicized violence is a very real thing in the Bible and in the world and in our world today. Good Lord, think of the whole summer and all the awful things that have happened, of this person killing that person, of running over protesters, of so many different things. And I got to just take a second and say, like, we're having this election. It's less than a month away. There will be violence after this election. There just will. I don't know if it'll just be a little bit in a few places or if it'll be a lot in a lot of places. There will be political violence after this election. We as faithful followers of Jesus need to figure out what we're going to do, how we're going to respond. How can we be the presence of Jesus in that time? Because that time is coming. And the time to think about it and consider what our actions might be is not when it happens, but it's now. Because we know it's going to happen. How can we faithfully follow Jesus when there will be political violence? There's already political violence in this country. All the time. Think about all the news out of Portland or a million other places. But we need to keep our eyes open to see what's really going on and to think about how we can be a witness for Jesus in these times. I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know what it'll look like for you. I don't know what it'll look like for me. But that is something we got to take real seriously. And it's something that happened, again, right here in the scriptures. They were dealing with some of these same issues. Because Jesus was challenging the power of the people in charge of the temple. He was challenging the entire religious order, which was functionally a political order in those days. Jesus was offering another way, saying that God had a different way of doing things, that God was going to try something new, that the established order of power and privilege and those structures were not permanent, were not going to last, and ultimately had outlived their usefulness as instruments of God's will for God's people, for God's world. It's not easy. I mean, there is good news in this story. The good news is that God can do new things, that God is doing a new thing right now. Just like God was then. It can look like bad news for those of us who have been around a while, those of us who benefit from the power that our religion bestows or that our politics bestow. People like me, to be honest, it can look bad for me when these changes happen. But ultimately, we know that God has a way forward for us, and that the way forward for us is not the way of violence. It's not the way of domination over other people. It's the way of Jesus, the way of forgiveness, the way of sacrifice, the way of caring for one another and caring for those who most need care in our society. It's the way of picking up those who have fallen down and of correcting those who have gone astray. I mean, that's part of the thing, too. That's what we're hearing in these stories today. But again, that's addressed to the powerful people who've let the power go to their heads, who've gotten greedy. It's not about punishing or focusing on the sins of everybody. It's those who've used their power to hurt others and to keep others down and to build those divisions between one another. It's not about rejecting the tradition we've inherited and we've helped establish, but it's about listening to what God will do next and putting the tradition that we've have, that we've received, and the lives that we've lived into the context of what's coming next so that it can serve God and not just our own interests. It's about seeking out the places and the people with whom God will be doing these new things and listening to them. In the coming weeks in our gospel lessons, Jesus will continue to challenge the religious authorities, which is us in part. And so we need to be open, not defensive. We need to find ways to learn from one another and from others outside of our church circle, outside of our perspective. We need to be willing to listen to one another. We need to seek out what God is doing. It's not easy to do when we're stuck in our homes and afraid of this pandemic, which is getting worse again. I feel like if everything up till this last week has been like the first part of this pandemic and the second worst part just started. And the numbers back that up, I think, almost. And certainly the news media backs that up. We have a lot to worry about. We have a lot of work to do. But Jesus is with us in these times. And if we can continue to communicate, continue to pray, continue to engage in the spiritual practices that keep us grounded in our faith, we can be the presence of Jesus in this world that needs Jesus' presence so much right now. We've got to figure out how to do it. Amen.